Democrats in particular emphasize that reducing qualified immunity, making it easier to fire bad cops, needs to be in legislation. Are you open to that?
Well, there are two ways that you could deal with that. From the Republican perspective, and the president has sent the signal that qualified immunity is off the table. They see that as a poison pill. On our side, we could use the decertification of officer, except for the law enforcement unions say that's a poison pill. So we're going to have to find a path that helps us reduce misconduct within the officers. But at the same time, we know that any poison pill in legislation means we get nothing done. That sends a wrong signal, perhaps the worst signal right now in America.
That was Republican Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina talking on Face the Nation Sunday about congressional efforts to pass police reform. Happy mid-June, Listenerville. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by my fellow long hairs, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, pals.
Howdy.
Hey, groovy, Matt. Groovy from the new shaggy southern Manhattan. I don't know.
I mean, you do.
Whatever.
You are giving a serious WKRP vibe over there in the corner.
I am Dr. Johnny Fever here, or Venus Flytrap.
Happy Monday, y'all.
Yeah.
Oh, did we get the Happy Monday back?
Yeah, that is Herb, or no, what was the name? Les Nesbitt.
Les Nesbitt.
Right, man? Yeah.
We are going to get out of the mid-1970s and into the nooks and crannies of criminal justice policy.
Into an even worse time, a worse timeline.
In a moment. But first, Freedom Fest is on, baby. The world's largest gathering for free minds will indeed take place July 13th to 16th at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. In fact, it'll be the first large person-to-person conference in Vegas since the coronavirus lockdown began. Go to www.freedomfest.com and use the code REASON75 before June 29, and you'll get $75 off your registration. Pay just $424, bring a friend for just $299. Room rates at Caesars Palace and the nearby Flamingo are ridiculously low, and parking is free. Freedom Fest is also for the first time offering a virtual attendee option. That's freedomfest.com. Go there, sign up. You'll be glad you did. All right. There was a ton of movement from the streets to the city halls, to the state houses, to Capitol Hill on reforming police conduct in this country in the wake of George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis. This is a topic that Reason has been writing about at great lengths for its entire 52-year run. Peter, you live in D.C. What's happening in the country in terms of criminal justice policy stuff?
So currently there is a whole bunch of action at both the state and the federal level. Let's talk about the federal level first. There are two competing federal bills right now, or sort of two, because one of them doesn't actually exist yet. Probably it will later this week. The short version is House Democrats have a big package of reforms. It does a whole bunch of stuff, including qualified immunity, changing qualified immunity to make it easier for people to sue the cops and recover damages. It subtly but significantly alters federal statute that says cops can get in trouble when they have willfully deprived of people of their constitutional rights previously. It currently says willfully. It would change that to recklessly. And so sounds like a small difference, but willfully implies knowledge. Recklessly just implies you did it and you shouldn't have. The House bill also makes it easier for the federal government to investigate police misconduct, increases the subpoena power of the federal government, incentivizes local police department to do racial bias training, bans chokeholds, bans no-knock warrants at the federal level for drug raids, creates a national police registry to centralize complaints about officers who engage in abusive policing, limits transfers of military equipment from federal government to the state and local cops. And Democrats want to do all of that stuff, and it's not going to happen. And so the argument right now is about what might actually happen. And that's the bill in the Senate, which is the Republican bill that's being put together by Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. And the Republican bill doesn't exist yet, but we have some sense of what the outlines are. And the outlines are it does some of the stuff that the Democratic bill in the House wants to do, but not all of it, and generally in a kind of a weaker manner. So it maybe bans chokeholds. It maybe establishes a national database of bad cops and police misconduct, and then allows for a kind of national decertification process. It almost certainly is going to require or incentivize police departments to train officers in de-escalation techniques, which some cities have already done. And it is almost certainly going to require or strongly incentivize local police departments to report violent incidents of police misconduct to the federal Department of Justice. What it definitely won't do, as we heard at the beginning, is touch qualified immunity at all. And a big reason for that is because the White House says that President Trump will not sign a bill that touches qualified immunity in any way. Trump is running on a law and order message and trying to make himself in many ways kind of the, you know, the candidate of the police in a lot of ways. And police officers' unions do not like when you mess with qualified immunity. The other thing we should just talk about real briefly is that there's a bunch of really interesting, in some ways more interesting stuff going on at the state level. And I would include, I would just point to New York, where Governor Cuomo signed a package of bills that bans chokeholds and also notably repeals a little known statute in the civil code known as 50A that pretty much makes it impossible to get records on police misconduct. CJ Sierra Morella has done a bunch on that. There's also some stuff happening in Washington, D.C. with a temporary package. There is a California, some movement in California. And then finally, also CJ Sierra Morella has written about this. There are a bunch of school districts that are saying we no longer want school resource officers, or at least not as they have currently been placed in schools. And so we are going to try and pull cops out of schools, because when you put cops in schools, what happens is that you end up with more policing, more arrests of kids in classrooms. And so there's just a whole bunch of stuff happening. It's a real hodgepodge. And right now, the big action is, or sort of the big debate is between the House bill, which says, let's do all the things, and Senate Republicans who are trying to say, well, let's not do all the things. Let's just do a few of them. And definitely let's not do qualified immunity.
And I would just add that the House bill in particular, since that's the one we know, as opposed to defunding anything, spends an extra amounts of billions on policing and such like.
Yeah, all of this kind of exists in the shadow of the defund the police argument, which is an interesting one and one we should probably talk about, but it's an argument that kind of means different things to different people. And everybody, the Democratic Party is kind of trying to like play nice with this argument while not in any way doing anything that really looks like defunding the police, certainly not through Congress.
Catherine, you're an anarchist. You look around the country. Do you see good news happening with some of these police reforms? What makes you happy?
I do see good news. I think it may be largely an effect of just my own psychological sine wave or something. Like, I'm just ready for some good news. I can't do the bad news anymore. But I do think there's some real good news out there. In addition to the stuff that Peter just mentioned, there is also Breonna's Law in Louisville, which bans the use of no-knock warrants and is really making me question my deep, deep commitment to the principle that if a law is named after a person, it is a bad law. Because this is a good law. Don't do no-knock raids, particularly on the houses of, for instance, people who are asleep and whose primary involvement in the alleged crime is being a mailing address sometimes used by drug dealers. Like, just don't do that. That's good news. Of course, New York, as we mentioned, Minneapolis announced that it was going to disband its police force. Again, a little bit unclear what that particular subvariant of defunding or disbanding, in this case, the police looks like and will look like in the future. We have a very good piece by J.D. Tuchilli on the site today, which says, hey, here's an idea. Maybe it will look different in different communities and we could let those communities decide for themselves. Just a wacky one. Let's think about it.
I mean, the model here is Camden, New Jersey, which actually did disband their police department, right. broke up the union, and then rehired a bunch of the police officers and eventually rehired more police officers, but paying them less. And the original union was broken up as part of this process.
And that, I think, is a really underappreciated element of the call to defund the police. I think there's, you know, the extent to which it is a backdoor union busting in some cases is something that the left doesn't want to talk about. But I am happy for the left to not talk about it if we just quietly do it.
A union rep in Camden, when that was happening, gave a quote to the New York Times that said, "This is definitely a form of union busting." I may be slightly misremembering.
Well, the unions obviously are going to point that out.
Definitely felt like that was union busting.
Right. And you know what? It is. And it should be, because the union should be busted. In D.C., Muriel Bowser signed an emergency order to ban neck restraints and also by police, and also to ban the use of tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets, and stun grenades against peaceful protesters. The list is kind of long. In Seattle, well, Seattle's its own whole sitch there. And I guess we can talk about the Chaz later, which, wow, like, I really wish we could go back in time and workshop that name a little bit. Sacramento, banning chokeholds. New Jersey, banning chokeholds. Basically, it just goes on and on and on. And this is exactly the type of thing that libertarians and anarchists should want to see. Like, of course Congress is going to get bogged down. Of course national politics is going to be a big garbagey mess of culture war showboating. Meanwhile, maybe people can actually get stuff done at the state and local level, as they always have.
Yeah, Nick, building on that, strikes me, and this could be my own bubble talking, but that kind of skim of awful people of which we are part of, who have, you know, policy and journalistic and discourse conversations on Twitter and elsewhere, it's as if they want to be herded into a fight over a phrase that doesn't have much to do with what, you know, the 3/4 of the American population want, which is actually, you know, criminal justice reform and support for the protesters who are peaceably demonstrating out there. It's as if we are not happy. And then it's the people who argue with people on Twitter, which is a subset of a subset, unless we can get into some fight, between looters and non-looters. Meanwhile, that there's all this actual work being done that's interesting and useful. It seems like there's a lesson there.
I don't know. I don't know what the lesson is. People are awful, and serious social reform typically goes on under the, beyond the spotlight. So if that's what you're talking about, I think a lot of the rhetoric coming out of not just Twitter people, but people in positions of power talking about abolish police, defund police, et cetera, they're coasting. They don't really know what they're talking about, nor do they care. And this is just a lot. There's a lot of really bad and potentially problematic sloganeering going on because it does get in the way of actual reforms. Every poll shows, 70% basically of people now say that deaths at the hands of police like George Floyd's represent a serious problem, a systemic problem that needs to be dealt with. That's up from the low 40s when Ferguson, Missouri took place in 2014. It's worth having good public and popular discussions about what can be done. And I think, busting the unions, I think explaining it and then explaining what qualified immunity is, how it came into being through judicial activism. It's not actually laws that were passed by anybody, what it takes to repeal that and why that wouldn't destroy the ability of policemen not to get sued every time they write a traffic ticket. These are serious things. I'm confident that we're going to get some really good criminal justice reforms, and particularly as it relates to police stuff. And I'm hopeful about that. I mean, if Catherine wants somebody to join her on the good ship Lollipop there for a couple of minutes, I think we're in a positive phase where something serious and real will happen. And for me, the other stuff, and it's kind of like the iceberg, there's a bad metaphor, like looming on the horizon.
Oh, God, it's the iceberg looming on the horizon of the good ship Lollipop.
Of the desert. Yeah, now.
Nick.
Yeah. Right. And Leonardo DiCaprio is in steerage on the good ship Lollipop.
He's tap dancing on the deck.
Well, he is American, but traveling with the eye. It gets very complicated. But
Nick, you're the king of the world right now.
One of the things that we need to think about is, how are we over policed? And we at Reason have talked a lot about the three felonies a day problem. I interviewed Bernie Carrick. We've talked to the author of Three Felonies a Day. What does it mean when you have a society in which at almost any given moment, just by walking down the street, you can be stopped for some pretext and then, you know, have to play nice with police who are terrifying, you know, to most people? That's a much longer term change in mentality. And I think that's ultimately where the conversation has to go, where how much are we over policing in the name of fending off crime that does not exist? And then, you know, just how do we make police better at their job so that they regain our trust and confidence after a really bad period, which we have to say is mostly their fault?
I'm fascinated by stats. We, of course, do not know the amount of deaths at the hands of police on a national scale for much longer than about 3 or 4 years that the Washington Post has been maintaining a database on that. But
it goes back to about 2014, and they have about 1,000 killings a year. And then when you look at unarmed people, you know, it's in the low two digits and things like that.
I think the unarmed component is going down. I would, just looking at, I mean, we do know some of those stats in individual places. And the numbers are staggering, as are the numbers of crime going down in general. In New York City in 1971, for example, there were more than 300 officer-involved shooting incidences, killing something like 93 people. And in 2018, there were, I think, like 17 total shootings by police against people and killing 10. That's amazing. As is the plummet and stuff. And I think sometimes we lose the context of all of this in the righteous zeal of the moment in looking at some of these awful things that you see circulated. Like yesterday, I was looking at some awful video from Albuquerque, New Mexico, which has had a very serious police problem for a long time of cops shooting up a homeless guy in a bus stop. It's just awful. Don't look for it. You know, like get escape from Twitter if you see that shared. It is so disturbing to watch. But Peter, Justin Amash makes a point out there. He's got a bill out that is just ending qualified immunity. I think Rand Paul might have something in the Senate that's more about no-knock raids, or it's about some other use of force. And they both make the argument that on the federal level, it is better to do a tiny little thing at a time rather than a big catch-all bill that you could sort of fundraise off and never have hope of being passed. Does that square with your take, or is that a kind of an unrealistic libertarian position that is just overwhelmingly outnumbered right now?
In some ways, I think it is an ideal for legislating. I'm not sure it's always the best way to get things done. So what you want from legislating is just to do the one right thing that is clearly the right thing to do, and you want to do that one bill at a time. Like that is usually a good way to go about reforming whatever institution, whether it's or part of the federal government, whether it's policing, whether it's healthcare, whatever. The issue is to get votes for these things, you often have to kind of package them together with a bunch of other things. And to build momentum, you often have to make the bills big. And so for political reasons, I think it's just more likely that something like whatever Senator Scott ends up coming up with ends up being passed and going into law. And it will be weak. It will, in many ways, it will be insufficient. There will be problems with it. We'll criticize it. On the other hand, he is right when he says that it is the Democratic bill, which tries to do a lot more, is a non-starter. And the qualified immunity stuff that that Justin Amash wants to do is also a non-starter because the president isn't there and isn't going to do it. And so the question is, in the face of political intransigence, what can you do? And often it turns out that the art of figuring out how to get something through the stupid political process is figuring out the package of reforms where everybody gets enough of what they want and not too much of what they don't, that you can get enough votes. Now, this is one of the reasons that people hate Congress. And one of the reasons that people hate politics and legislating is that's the ball game. That's the actual way that everything works, is that you always kind of have to package the good stuff with some really with some stale and crappy stuff, and the sandwich is never gonna be right. I mean, I'm building a legislation sandwich here. It's always gonna have a little bit of stale lettuce in it, even if the bacon is really crispy and good.
You know what it is though? It's a Dagwood sandwich. Is that still a reference that we can use? It's a Dagwood. They're always enormous. They're so big you can't actually take a bite of them. I mean, this is there is in fact a like super smoking hot counter conventional wisdom take that earmarks are good precisely because they allow you to use a more fungible currency to do this thing that Peter just described, right? That you can basically just almost literally hand sacks of money to different districts in order to buy the votes you need to get the thing through. I am not sure that I'm persuaded by that take in the end, but smart people, including I think Reason contributor Jonathan Rauch, has walked down that line from time to time.
Certainly the case that the end of earmarks as incentives, let's say, for people to vote for big packages has correlated with a breakdown in the congressional process.
Because you might as well just fight the culture war and go all in on the showmanship, you know, if you're not going to get a bag of money.
The other question, though, is that there are times where specific pieces of legislation can be forced through. I mean, Tim Scott, every bit as much as Trump and the Democrats, they are, they're anteing up here. So he's not whatever ends up being voted on. He's just coming in and saying, OK, this is our opening bid, and qualified immunity is a non-starter, et cetera. You know, Congress and the Senate in particular is filled with enough weasels that if they got 15 calls from angry people saying, you better fucking do this, otherwise we're going to keep marching on, your office, your state capitol, who knows what's possible. I think that the larger question, and I think there is reason to be cynical about the Democratic Party. They clearly, I mean, we cannot forget that this is all taking place during a presidential election year where you have, next to Barack Obama in 2012, you have, the most vulnerable incumbent in a hell of a long time. And the Democrats want to do whatever they can to get him out of office. And playing up everything that is going on now is a massively great way to do that. And I think there are many, many moderate people in America who dislike Donald Trump. And also, they do not sign on to an extreme version of Black Lives Matter, but they are uncomfortable with what they saw in the George Floyd video, and they're right to be, and they're right to understand that there are cops don't need to be individually racist to be involved in a system that perpetuates racial disparities in the way that laws are enforced. And my hope for all of this, beyond what we're talking about here, is that this really will energize the conversations about ending the drug war, because the drug war is one of the main ways through which police have more contact with more people in less accountable ways, than ever. And it's good. Like, we should expect our cops to be great and to be honest and to be on the job, but we shouldn't expect them to be everywhere, including directing traffic. You know, that's one of the most interesting conversations coming out of all of this, is people are finally saying, why the fuck are we having people who might be making 75 grand a year and getting a pension, health benefits, et cetera, and they're fucking directing traffic? Like, what, they're writing parking, writing tickets. What the hell's going on here? That's a good conversation to be having.
The polling aspect of this is one of the most interesting, and it's just worth kind of highlighting a little bit. Nick, you've talked about this, but the shift in public opinion over the past 5 years or so has really been incredible, where you now see, like you said, about 70% of Americans saying that George Floyd's killing represented a systemic problem with American policing. And if you go back to 2014, when Eric Garner was killed by police in New York, you had a majority of Americans saying, oh, well, this is just an isolated incident. And for a variety. Yes, just another isolated incident. They were basically like agreeing. They were agreeing with the police line that Radley Balco headlines were always making fun of. And that was the prevailing view in 2014, not very long ago. And a bunch of things have changed. And the piece I wrote last week argued that one of the factors is that we now have so many videos of police misconduct that it has just turned, you know, we have all of these anecdotes that have become data in the public mind and have changed people's minds. And then the other part of it is that activists have, in political protests have really made this an issue and put this into the public mind and the political agenda in a way that it simply wasn't, certainly 10 years ago and really not even 6 or 8 years ago. And so this is one of the most rapid, significant shifts on a political issue that I've seen in my lifetime. I think the only other two things that I can think of in the last 20 years are gay marriage and pot legalization.
Correct. Nick, before we leave the topic, do you want to tell people about your, I think, forthcoming interview with Radley Balco?
Yeah, I think it's going up. It may be up before this podcast is up because, you know, we're messing with the space-time continuum here at Reason in an attempt to always be on the cutting edge. On the cutting edge of that iceberg float down on the horizon where the good ship Lollipop is plugged in via Tesla engines in outer space. Or maybe it's inner space. Golly, you know, maybe we're all just crumbs in the beard of Lanny Friedland. What were we talking about, Matt Welch?
We have a
very good interview with Radley Balco, former Reason reporter and editor who has written about the militarization of police and the faultiness of expert testimony and, the ways in which the drug war in particular have really screwed up policing. Very interesting. He's at the Washington Post now. It's a great interview to talk about why did the George Floyd killing take off in the way that it did? And then what are the best kind of reforms that can actually be done? And they track very closely with a lot of what we've been writing about at Reason and what Peter was talking about in his recent excellent piece on the matter.
Okay, we're going to pivot to the ongoing nervous breakdown within liberal institutions and especially the media. But first, Freedom Fest is kicking off its annual conference in Vegas, July 13th, with a special emergency meeting hosted by Steve Forbes to examine the impact of the coronavirus scare and subsequent lockdowns on the economy, the financial markets, the healthcare system, the ongoing protests, the November elections, and our constitutional freedoms. Keynote speakers include Dr. Drew Pinsky and talk show superstar Dave Rubin. The MC will be popular libertarian comedian Dave Smith. There will again be a Reason Day at Freedom Fest on July 14th featuring Nick Gillespie, Robbie Suave, Corey DeAngelis, among others. Go to freedomfest.com and use the code Reason75 before June 29th to receive $75 off your registration. You'll pay just $424. Bring a friend for $299. Rates at Caesar's Palace and the Flamingo are super cheap. Parking is free. Freedom Fest will be engaging in all the appropriate physical distancing and cleaning to make sure we can all stay healthy and free. And for those who cannot travel at this time, there's also a virtual attendee option. Visit www.freedomfest.com. Sign up today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. The institutions of liberalism continue to experience management shakeups, policy changes, and staff revolts over allegedly toxic and or racist atmospheres and actions. A couple of random bullet points, although there's literally scores happening over this past couple of weeks. The Academy Awards last week announced that in order to qualify, films must hit certain representation and inclusion standards. UCLA suspended a lecturer after he refused to make his final exam a no harm test for students of color, and so on. Catherine, I have been made to understand via a communication device that is popular in workplaces that you have an unnaturally vast knowledge of what happened with the, I believe, Condé Nast property, Bon Appetit. Do you care to travel down that rabbit hole and maybe pull out something that we can find of use in broader applications to our ongoing nervous breakdown in our liberal institutions?
Yeah, I want to be clear. I have an unnaturally vast knowledge of the oeuvre of Bon Appetit generally. And so my knowledge about its current breakdown and scandals simply cascades from that. I just want to be clear. Bon Appetit, managed to turn itself very, very interestingly from a pretty boring, glossy food magazine to a pretty good glossy food magazine, but more importantly, a online video empire with just like millions and millions of hits on these very quirky videos in which the staff of the test kitchen, which is just what you imagine. It's in, I think it's actually in the World Trade Center building. It's this beautiful Manhattan building. It's the Condé Nast gestalt there, a wide open kitchen. And there's all these staffers who have individually branded shows or group shows where they teach you how to cook stuff. But it's kind of a soap opera too. Like, they're friends. They pop in and out. Maybe more like a sitcom than a soap opera. So that is the background. And I just want to be clear that I watch all of them, like 100% of them. And there's a lot of them. And I watch them all. It was the one good, pure thing in 2020. Everything else has gone into a giant steeping garbage pile and I hate it. And Bon Appetit was my happy place. So, of course, everything went to hell there, too. Adam Rappoport is the editor-in-chief. And even in his occasional even in his occasional cameos in the videos before, it was clear that the entire staff hated him and he was maybe kind of a jerk. Like, seriously, every time he showed up on screen, it was like all side eye all the time. This was partially because he was not himself primarily a cook or a chef. He was an editor of the other lifestyle publications and was brought in to do Bon Appetit. So anyway, turns out he did brown face and also everyone already hated him. And then the death blow was an allegation that while certain staffers were being paid for their appearances in these blockbuster videos, others were not. And those who were not were people of color. Now, I have a bunch of reactions to this. One is, I totally believe that Adam Rappoport is a jerk bag, so that's fine. I mean, I don't know him, but like, it seems pretty plausible. He may or may not have been a racist jerk bag. I don't know him. It seems possible, but I really don't know. But I do think there's been an interesting kind of misunderstanding about how contracts in HR work. So the main star, the biggest star, Claire Saffitz, threatened to quit because she thought she was being underpaid for her videos. And then they changed her contract and she became a contractor who was paid per video. Some people are on staff and get paid a salary and appear in videos. Now, you can fight about whose salaries are right and whether the representation is right and all that other stuff. But there's just this fundamental misunderstanding of like how like different types of employment might work, because people are pretty illiterate about that in this country. And I think that's an underappreciated piece of this. And in fact, at many of these kerfuffles within publications, the exact employment status of specific writers and where they sit in the hierarchy of the publication often really, really matters in how you interpret their words or their videos or their pay. And people are generally ignoring that and saying that one writer or one voice speaks for everyone and everyone should be treated identically, which is not true.
It's a little bit like the cable news thing where if you go on television and you if you're watching cable news and you see someone who is listed as, for example, a CNN contributor, that means that person is being paid somehow or another, possibly a monthly rate, possibly a per appearance rate, but they are being paid. If you see someone who is just a guest, in virtually all cases, that person is not being paid to go on television, although they may be covering some amount of travel expenses associated with your appearance.
I'm amazed, Catherine, you described the, I haven't watched any of these videos, but you described the antics as kind of like an ongoing soap opera or something. From the reading that I did about it, it sounded more like it was the series Oz on HBO. It seemed like, you know, it's just like in every episode, somebody's being blown to bits and walled up and, you know, firebombed and harassed and assaulted.
The knives are real, though, not homemade.
I mean, to be clear, the Claire Saffitz show Gourmet Makes, the concept of it is she takes commercially available like Pop-Tarts or, you know, Pocky or, you know, Choco Tacos and tries to make them herself. And it is like there are explosions sometimes, because if you try to duplicate commercial industrial processes, yeah,
is there race-based gang warfare? I guess
it turned out that,
like,
I guess
us,
right below the surface. Yeah. Yes, there was.
Is this the one where you learned how to make the Shake Shack burger?
Yes. actually. No, it's not. So it was a vote on a petite recipe, but not a video. The larger frame
here about the inability of legacy media or woke media, and they're two different things, because like Refinery 29 isn't quite legacy media. It was absorbed by Vice. They went through a public shaming where, you know, they walked all of the leaders out of the building and put dunce caps on their head and had them march alongside Hasidic Jews in Williamsburg or something like that to show how sorry they were for being awful. Condé Nast is literally condensing and collapsing in the World Trade Center, where they used to have like 100 floors. Now they're down to, you know, a couple of custodians' closets. It's a shrinking pie, and people are getting kind of pissed about all of that kind of stuff. And I think the fact that Condé Nast, which also there's a big Time story about how Anna Wintour and her minions have not been racially sensitive enough over the years. You know, there's something going on there. And I think what we're seeing throughout a lot of the mainstream media is more, it's a generational power grab. There have been people who have been around for a long time. The business models of a lot of these organizations are collapsing. And there are people, you know, the younger generation wants to move up the masthead. And they will use whatever clubs are available to them. Matt, there's a reason why you and I are editors at large and Catherine and Peter are editors, right? You know, it happens. And it's just, you know, in our case,
I think of myself they were as able an editor at small.
Yeah, that. Well, I was going to say, in your cases, rather than using, you know, grievances about 10 or 15 year old Instagram pictures and Halloween costumes, you were able to use superior talent and ambition in order to move up the masthead and squeeze us into, some kind of day room at the asylum. But I think that's a big part of what's going on here. It's a rubber room.
The reason DC HQ podcast booth is very rubber room like.
Yeah,
like, if you imagine
a rubber room in your head, it's amazing that people are not like, I'm amazed. Like, James Bennett firing, and I guess we talked about that last week, did we? I have no sense of time anymore since becoming editor at large. That's really when
technically he resigned.
I gave up calendars at that point. Like, there's something messed up where you have somebody who built a page, which is, you know, the biggest editorial page on the planet. And then because he runs a shitty, you know, op-ed by Tom Cotton, it's like, okay, get the fuck out and don't let the door hitch on the way out. I'm not saying he should be there. I'm not a big fan of the New York Times op-ed page, partly because they generally, when I pitch something, they turn it down. So I'm like, screw that. But having said all of that, the unwillingness of these institutions to even know what they stand for and then defend themselves against often reckless charges of that oftentimes are, you know, don't amount to that much more than I was an intern and I was not being taken that seriously in staff meetings.
I mean, so this is the thing, though, like just very briefly, like, I think it's so often the case that when these things do come to a head, there is a kernel of something real in there. And that's the thing that ideally management at these places would take seriously without having to go full like self-abasement followed by resignation every single time. I mean, in the case of Bon Appetit, Sola, who started the insurrection, legit is super talented and apparently was being really pretty severely underpaid. And that may or may not be benefit because she was a person of color, but it's true that if you are a viewer or a consumer, you feel that it is manifestly unfair how she has been treated. Similarly, the Tom Cotton op-ed, it was pretty bad, I think. It was pretty bad op-ed. Not only were its contents bad, but also its writing and structure weren't great. That's fair. Again, there's a kernel there. That op-ed kind of sucked. Could it have been better? Maybe could it have been better if there had been a little more editorial supervision on it? Yes and yes. Should you have to then like grovel, have your life ruined, and then depart in shame? Probably not. But if you don't
and
have a
the
theory,
claim
if you don't
Tom
have a counter
Cotton...
theory of, well, why is it that I shouldn't leave groveling in shame? Then you're going to wind up leaving groveling in shame. You have to have a clear vision, as Nick says, of what you're doing and why.
And, you know, the idea that the Tom Cotton op-ed was somehow putting staff members of the New York Times at physical risk, in danger, is insane. I mean, we have to admit that is like a, you know, a junior high level debate tactic, which is stretches beyond any bounds of reality. I think that any of us would be comfortable living in. And then that becomes, you know, the operational way to get rid of. Yeah, well, you know, then James Bennett, it's like, was he going around like, you know, pulling weapons on people or something by dint of all of that? There is such an unreality to many of the charges that are being made, where a lot of this stuff is basic editorial policy and things like that. And it's true that people should, you know, they should get paid, you know, in my way of it thinking, they should get paid slightly more than what they're worth, you know, but that, you know, the fact that people are talking in the way that they are, it just seems like it is, it's a way of masking a will to power, which is what editorial mastheads are all about, you know, with other types of charges that are not really legitimate.
Peter, there's been a series of pretty interesting essays and pieces written about all of this. Our own Robbie Suave had a piece with the 1793 Project as a headline. Andrew Sullivan had a piece in New York Magazine. Matt Taibbi, his own newsletter. Ross Douthat actually had a pretty good piece.
Can we get a pronunciation? Nope. Is it Douthat?
No, Douthat.
Or is it Douthat?
I can't.
Do you that?
Whatever it is, I can't do it. Nor can I do
you can't
Mari. At any rate, Peter, the argument that those people who I named mention and worry about, and one of the reasons why they're being exercised to the point of saying, my God, what's going on here? I would also include Thomas Chatterton Williams, who's a writer I'm growing increasingly fond of by the second, is that this is all an open expression of illiberalism. This is liberal institutions saying, you know what, the Enlightenment wasn't all that, which is a strange mirror of the aforementioned Sohrab Ahmari argument, which is like, we need to abandon the Enlightenment from a conservative point of view and grab a bigger club so that we can that we can win with a hashtag, preferably. Do you see this as liberal institutions openly abandoning liberalism, and does it also give you the tremors?
If you think of the Enlightenment as primarily or at least heavily being about the idea that speech isn't violence, then in some ways, yes. And I think that is maybe not the only tenet of the Enlightenment and of, you know, of liberalism in the American era, but it is a core tenet. And this is what the First Amendment is about. This is what the kind of Enlightenment ideal, not always lived up to, clearly even by people who espoused it, who were kind of originators of this idea. But this is the idea that kind of underlies so much of Enlightenment democracy, which is that speech might be troubling, it might be worth arguing with, but that in no consistent and systematic cases is it violence, and that we need to distinguish speech from violence. And the young left has decided that speech is violence, and that speech harms people, and that people need to be protected from the violence of speech. And so that is why you saw New York Times staffers rally around the idea that the Tom Cotton op-ed put people in danger. It wasn't an argument that it was a bad op-ed. It wasn't an argument that he was a bad person, that he was a Republican. It wasn't even directly, although it sort of it wasn't even directly an argument that Tom Cotton is a racist, although it was the statement was this op-ed puts Black New York Times staffers' lives in danger. It was instead one that the words and the publication of the words, simply printing them, going to have the effect of harming people's bodies. And now look, you can say maybe this is a special case because he was calling for using state power to quell violent protests. Although some of the Times' descriptions of this, when people would object, would say, "Well, he was calling, using the military against against protesters." No, the actual language of the piece was he said, "Look, peaceful protesters, the military shouldn't be touching them. Instead, what we want is for to use the military to quell violent unrest, which there had been in many cities in the country." And so you can kind of say, okay, this is a call for that. But no, this was not actual violence. It was simply words, words printed. I don't know if it actually ran in the print edition, but words on paper, words on a screen. It wasn't violence itself. And if you think of the Enlightenment, if you think of liberalism as largely being about that idea that words are not violence, then yeah, there is an element of the, certainly of the young left, and then weirdly of the new nationalist right giving up on that core tenet of liberalism and in the Enlightenment. And I think it is extremely worrying, and I think it just bodes very darkly for the future of free speech as everyone on this podcast thinks of it.
I'm more optimistic about it. I don't think it's particularly helpful to skip to the Enlightenment writ large, as Hayek and everybody else who studies the Enlightenment will always start off by saying there's no Enlightenment. There are multiple Enlightenments. And there's no question, and I think this is part of what energizes people, you know, the Enlightenment did give us science, which gave us scientific racism. And when you go back and you look at the history of the Enlightenment, you have, you know, completely intertwined theories of specifically racial hierarchy done in the most scientific language imaginable, alongside doctrines of things like individual autonomy and freedom of individual freedom and political rights for everybody, for universal, you know, human rights. So it's a complicated thing. What we're talking about here is the idea of free speech. Do we want to live in a society that tolerates more speech or tolerates less speech? We are clearly in a spasm where things are contracting. Places like the New York Times, to the extent that they do this and they purge every aspect, I can only imagine that the acrostics or whatever the fuck they have at the end of the New York Times must be the most politically correct crossword puzzles of all times or something like that. But, you know, they're welcome to do that. It's within their right, and they will become less of a paper of record when they become transparently unfair, unobjective, uninterested in describing the world, including on their op-ed page. That's a loss. It's not a terrible loss. What is problematic is that at all points, people are trying to shut down conversations that are happening. It's actually good news for places like Reason, because, you know, we are honest brokers. We have a point of view, but I think we're honest brokers of what we're doing, what we're looking at. We're constantly engaging our own sets of ideas. And, you know, Reason looks very different now than it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or 50 years ago, while there are continuities. This is all good.
But one of the big tactics that's being used to shut down those conversations is just the argument that this speech, this language, these words make me feel, or make someone who I know feel, unsafe, that they are. And it is a very worrying to me conflation of speech with violence.
We talked about this a little last week, but I guess my theme this week is maybe people in journalism don't understand, or activism don't understand very well, how business works and the legal and regulatory structures that operate there. But we talked last week about the fact that that particular choice of language by New York Times employees in this context had to do with the fact that there is an extra protection for speech by workers if they are trying to express that they are endangered by their employer, if they are in physical danger, if they are at risk because of the terms of their employment, that speech has extra layers of protection around it. So by choosing that language, not only are they tapping into this gigundo thing that we just alluded to that has to do with the Enlightenment and all kinds of other deep, deep roots in this debate, but also the very narrow regulatory environment in which we operate, in which that type of speech is the least likely to get shut down. It's a strategic choice, and it's something that employers are particularly defenseless against, because they risk taking on a whole labor dimension to the whole mess, in addition to the speech dimension, the canceling, and 17 other things that are already going on.
We know this because it was reported in the New York Times in a Ben Smith column about this, who wrote about the employee revolt and against the cotton op-ed. And so people start tweeting about it. And then there's this bit from the Ben Smith piece. The News Guild of New York later advised staff that staff members, that formulation was legally protected speech because it focused on workplace safety. Quote, it wasn't just an opinion. It felt violent, to be clear. It was a call to action that could hurt people, one union activist said about Mr. Cotton's column.
I also think this stuff is a little bit separate from what we were talking about, Condé Nast, where you have a lumbering giant who is, you know, thick in waist and thick in brain. And there are new people who are coming up with different ways of doing stuff, and they want to get compensated for that, not having watched the videos. But it's like, yeah, you know, go for it. And by the way, like, leave Condé Nast. You know, this is also, to me, a lot of the generational tumult that's going on that I find odd. And Matt, as a Gen Xer, I think, and as an expatriate, I seem to recall, I know you don't like to talk about it, but you actually left the country.
Sure did.
And started a bunch of papers elsewhere. What weirds me out or is odd to me is that people are really unhappy with where they work. And then they say, you know, this is the worst place ever. And they won't leave and start their own thing when it's easier than ever to do that. You know, they want to stay where they are. And to me, that is something generationally I have difficulty understanding.
I would sort of as an adjunct to that, just say, you know, why leave when you can take over the place from within?
I guess, but it's a rotting husk.
Catherine,
you take it over and it's worth nothing.
I didn't mean that to be quite as much of like bills. A supervillain laugh as I think it came out like. It was like, yes, indeed. Why leave when you could take over?
You did the creepy fingers. Okay, listen, we're going to pivot to our what we have been consuming on a cultural basis. But first, here's what Freedom Fest honcho Mark Skousen says. We are determined to defend our First Amendment right as American citizens to freedom of assembly. End quote. Join the fight for freedom alongside such stalwarts as Senators Mike Lee and Rand Paul, John Fund, Steve Moore, Jennifer Grossman, Jenny Beth Martin, and George Gilder, plus organizations like Reason, Free the People, Young Americans for Liberty, the Libertarian Party, and more. If you can be there in person, please use the code REASON75 to get your 75 smackaroonies off. If you can't travel but still want to support the freedoms, become a virtual attendee. Visit freedomfest.com. You'll be glad you did. Okay, Peter Suderman, what have you been consuming on a cultural basis?
I watched Da Five Bloods, which is the new Spike Lee film that debuted on Netflix over the weekend. It is a movie about a quartet of Vietnam veterans who go back to Vietnam to revisit the scene of a battle they were involved in which their commander died. Their mission is to recover his body because it was never recovered, but what you also find out is that along the way, they are trying to recover a strong box full of gold bullion that they had liberated in the name of taking for themselves and at the time, their commander had said, this is going to be our way of paying reparations. And so you have this kind of fascinating twin timeline, war story, adventure story, military buddy story, story about colonialism and racism and, you know, military misadventure. The movie opens with a kind of this incredible collage of historical footage from the 60s and 70s that just makes the case for the ways that systemic racism was bound up in the war against Vietnam and the way that the war in Vietnam hurt black men the most and sort of was also contributed to racist policing and all of this. And I'm going to say all of that. And you know, this is a Spike Lee movie. It is intensely engaged with ideas about America and race and all of that stuff. It's a very political film, and I wouldn't want to say otherwise. But what it also really is just an incredibly well-made piece of film art. And Spike Lee just knows how to use a camera, how to edit, how to mix in music in a way that is, I just find overwhelming sometimes, in the best possible way. And all of his movies tend to get sort of dragged into a cult, not dragged into a culture war. He is dragging his movies into a culture war. But what the effect of that is that people don't talk enough about what an absolutely brilliant filmmaker, just on a level of shots, cuts, composition, music, this guy is. And Defy Bloods is that. It is not a perfect film. It is often a little bit too on the nose politically. There's one of the characters played by Delroy Lindo is a Trump supporter, and so all of these guys have to talk about how he is a Trump supporter, and does that make him, you know, not part of their brotherhood anymore? Of course he's part of it, but then it gets very complicated as things start to go very bad in the middle of the movie, as you might expect. And it's just such a marvelously complex and human and humane and technically sophisticated film. And it was just a pleasure and a joy to watch it this weekend after a bunch of months of watching stuff that was, you know, just straight to VOD, kind of maybe this is okay, this is pretty good. No, here is a real, real movie made by a real, real filmmaker. And it's just a joy to be able to watch something like that again after so long not being able to.
Very glad to hear that. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I have read Carla Gerecki's, or Carla Gerek. I know her and cannot pronounce her last name, Gerike. Former head of the Free State Project, Carla Gerek wrote a collection, or published a collection, of essays, short stories, and other writings called The Ecstatic Pessimist, Stories of Hope, mostly. And it's a fantastic package of writings that, as I said, veer from fiction to autobiography and memoir to political polemics. Carla was born and raised and educated in South Africa, left there and moved to San Francisco, where she worked as a lawyer for a tech firm, and then ended up in New Hampshire, where she still is. And for a long time, she ran the Free State Project in one of its most successful moments. And it's great. It mixes stories about substance abuse and lack of focus, historical wrongs, and kind of utopian attempts to remake the world in a better place in a very pragmatic way. So I highly recommend The Ecstatic Pessimist, Stories of Hope, mostly by Carla Gerek.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
You know, we have not talked about coronavirus at all this podcast, and I appreciate that, but also, even though many states and cities are reopening somewhat, a thing that is not reopening is large group activities for children. So many of you, our dear listeners, might still have ankle biters in your house. If you do, I recommend to you the board game One Night Werewolf. It's a very, very simple board game. It's basically Mafia. You're just trying to find the werewolf in the midst of the villagers, but it is structured so beautifully. It has a great little app that has a comically sinister voice narrating it. Villagers, wake up. It's very good. And my six-year-old, who has a very, very short attention span, can play it, which means anyone can play it. He loves it. He begs us to play. And as a parent, you will not hate it because each round is very, very short. You can say yes to playing this game with your child and not still be there 1 hour later wishing to die. It's objectively fun. It is good to play with adults and alcoholic beverages if, for instance, you are having small gatherings of under 10 people in your home or whatever is legal or illegal wherever you are. And finally, if, for instance, there was some tension in your household and you were all kind of sick of each other, pointing fingers and shouting at each other in the context of the game might be a healthy outlet for that. One Night Werewolf, genuinely fun, cheap, great, short, and I recommend it not only to the youths, but also to the olds.
Sold. Holy cow. I will close out on something that is super micro specific and wouldn't be applicable to 99.9% of you, except maybe there's a general theme. And that is, over the weekend, I went on a marvelous little art walk in my own neighborhood, organized by the Gowanus Dredgers Club, which is this marvelous organization of people who like to canoe through one of the most polluted waterways.
Oh my God.
Ever created through the black mayonnaise. Like
this is what happened to the Tidy Ball Man
of the Gowanus Canal. But we now belong to the group, and they have a street artist, Gowanus, this area of Brooklyn. For a long time housed big squats full of artists, and there's a big artist tradition and an annual art walk thing, and he just sort of walked us through the same streets that we otherwise walk and pointing out tiny little stickers that are on fire hydrants, and it's that artist and it's this tradition. There's a thing I didn't realize that happened, but locally there is a group of artist created history stickers of, like, you know, George Washington and the Battle of Brooklyn kind of thing. They look like official documents, but they're all created by artists. Super great. Like, discovered that a bridge that we used to walk on when we had school in session on a daily basis, and it's where Robert De Niro threw his gun off in The Irishman. Just to restart that fight, that there's a local artist who puts little magnet wings on them, little tiny magnet wings, and if you walk across them, you can find it and take them home. That kind of stuff. What I love about all of that, and this is where it becomes more applicable, is that it's just awesome to take tours of where you live from people who notice things differently. It opens your eyes in ways that is really kind of thrilling. Have done that in the past in Los Angeles and other places, and I love it, and it just sort of expands your horizons without really having to travel all that far. That's all the mind expansion horizon fun we have time for here. Stay tuned for All Reason Podcasts. Go to reason.com podcasts. Thank you for listening, and we shall see you again, squeaking the chairs, next week. Goodbye.